this show is not for the easily offended. So if you are easily offended, go listen to something else.
Welcome to Indie Comic Book Noise, episode 394. It's the podcast sponsored by nobody, with your host, Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker, and Andrew the L.A. Rabbit
in L.A.,
and Phil
in Ottawa.
I feel like I haven't seen you guys forever.
And Kevin, surrounded by lakes. You can listen to us from IndieComicBookNoise.com and find old shows there, and find us on Twitter at IndieComicBookN, or visit our Facebook page, as well as listen to us on our sister show, Marvel Noise, where we talk about the Marvel books we're reading and keep a predictable schedule.
It looks like the sky is moving, the clouds are moving behind the full moon right now. So if I turn into a werewolf or something, you know.
Ow.
I'll shoot you.
Werewolf.
Werewolf. Werecastle.
All right. What have you guys been reading? Anything good? I have. I've been reading a lot of indie books.
Keep on telling us repeatedly that you have a lot of books.
It must be because Marvel's doing such a bad job right now.
I think this episode is brought to us by Dark Horse Comics, because I've got all three of my books are Dark Horse books.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Oh, so you have Black Hammer, Ether. What else do I read?
Oh, Ether. I got that.
Ah, there we go.
Two issues of Ether from Dark Horse. Writer Matt Kint and art by David Rubin. Great art by David Rubin. The design, the coloring he uses, he inflicts humor into his figure work and stuff. This is a very entertaining book to read. It reads real smooth, and there's a lot to slow down and look at.
I'm an uber Rubin fan, because I know some, you see some people out there saying how big of a fan they are, and people are really big fans. Like, I like his work, but I'm nowhere near the uber fan that I see other people are.
This is the first time I can recall seeing his stuff, but I probably have, but just haven't connected it to the name. Ether is about this middle-aged, like, Alan Quartermain, Indiana Jones type. He's an explorer, adventurer, scientist, naturalist type named Boone. And he's found access to, like, an interdimensional crossroads that allows him entrance into the Ether, which is, like, this mystical land seemingly bound by magic, but Boone's empirical observations are able to pretty much explain everything adequately by science, which makes him a useful person to get his opinion on things, because he sees things from outside the box, where everyone else is just very quick to say, well, it's magic. At the crossroads, there's this, like, ape-like guardian character who is sentient and verbal and everything. And in order to enter the Ether, like, he's got this funny relationship with the ape-like guy that there has to be some, like, agitation to get him to break the plane. So he usually, like, kicks him in the ass, right, to knock him into the Ether, which is pretty funny to build up the potential tumbling. And the Guardian serves the Blaze, who's this warrior woman that protects the Ether and, it seems like, maybe all of reality. After they introduce everything, they get the conflict. Boone gets rushed to the Blaze's tower, and she's been murdered. So there's a mystery to solve, and he's the guy for the job. And they're slowly revealing his past history in leading up to his discovery of the Ether, and then his early exploration of the Ether. And they keep referring to past continuity, like he comes across characters that he's met in his earlier adventures exploring the Ether, and you don't really know where they stand with each other yet, but it looks like more will be, you know, it's kind of on a need-to-know basis, but it's a well-crafted book. I'm really digging it so far.
I didn't know how to feel after reading the first one. Usually with Matt Kint, I'm there, like, all the way, but it was something weird about the book, like, I don't know. It's hard to describe.
So I'm going to dig a Matt Kint book, and it's going to be the one that, like, all the Metkin fans are like, nah, son.
I know, right?
I'm like that, though. I like there was like I had a buddy who was really into REM when I was in grad school, and an album came out, and I was like, I'm digging almost every song on this album. And he's like, this is like the album that all the REM fans don't like. I'm like, oh, sorry.
No, I don't think it's a bad book. It was just, I was just like, I don't know. It didn't bowl me over. I was just like, okay, okay. I guess it reminded me of Ninjak. So I don't know, maybe you would like Ninjak, Steve. But some of the stuff, I'm just like, I noticed like some of the storytelling things like he's used in other places. And it's perfectly fine to be using them for this story, but I don't know, something about it, I was just like, yeah, that's weird. Oh, he can do this and do that, and he's pointing out these tools, and I'm like, that's what Ninjak would do.
Yeah, I like that. They do little...
I got a Ninjak shirt the other day. Ah.
They point out, like, some of his equipment and things, and it's kind of cool. It, yeah. There's a steampunky type element to his level of sophistication, which is fun.
There's also another, that other mystery of, at the end of the, maybe it was the thing at the end of the first issue, too. So I was kind of like, where is this going? Like this could be a good reveal or, you know, not so good, I guess. Like, he's crazy or something.
Well, there's a, it gets explained that he loses, like he can't digest food when he's in the ether. So he can only stay in the ether for as long as he can stand it because his body needs to, it can't absorb any nutrients, not even what he ate earlier. So he's got to like eat and digest enough to have enough fuel to go. And then as soon as he comes back to home reality, he's a wreck. He's just got to eat and he's starving. So it shows him almost being like a destitute bum. And you got to, like you said, you're wondering, is this, you know, is this, has he been there the whole time? But stick with it. I promise.
Yeah. At least for the artwork. Like, jeez.
That's your good art fan. take your shots, hater.
I have the whole series on order. Like, I was just I just got to order the whole series. So, you know, it's not like I'm going anywhere. That's what I'd usually do, don't they? I go, oh, the art, ooh. And then everyone goes, what, you didn't like the art? And I go, no, I love the art.
Who's got book?
I got book. A couple episodes ago, me and Andrew talked about the 25 Cent Red Sonja book. And I was disappointed Andrew didn't read it yet, the number one. But then I remembered it just came out today, so that makes sense.
Yeah, we had to get down on me, Phil. I don't always get to the comic book story. You know what? It takes me a long time.
Do you think you're going to be picking up this series? Like from the 25 Cent comic you got?
I don't know. It really depends on if it's in stock.
It depends on what you say over the next 5 minutes.
Did it pick you up enough, though, like that 25 Cent issue?
I liked it, but it wasn't anything that really was an essential that it's like, oh, I gotta definitely buy it. But I'm like, if I see it and I don't buy a lot of other books, then yeah, to fill out the stack, I'll probably grab it. But if I got a fat stack of other books, then it's gonna get put to the side.
Yeah, and last time we didn't know who the bad guy was, but it was Kulon Gath.
Sure.
I believe you pronounce his name.
Yes.
But basically, it continues right from there, and it's just her with the cops all around her, and they end up shooting her, and she's all like, oh, this is magic. Like, basically, no one can understand what she's saying, but there's this one cop, Max, who can, and he doesn't know why or anything. Yeah, he has one off comment. What was that?
Red Sonja's in modern times, you should say.
Yeah, in New York.
Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah. In Manhattan, I think.
Hmm.
And, so basically, he has a throwaway comment where it's he learned some languages from his mom, but he has no clue what it is. So I'm guessing she is from that time. I don't know if they're treating this as a different dimension or the future.
If she becomes a pimp and gets like a white tiger on a leash, I'm going to crack up.
She's half naked the whole issue. Well, so you don't have to
worry about Sonya. That. Red Sonya should not back away from the cheesecake element. She's a warrior in a chainmail bikini.
Exactly. But yeah, basically, so she comes this time, the cops end up grabbing her, and she goes to a mental institution who happens to be run by Kulan Gath.
Oh.
Like, it's like they all have these tattoos of a symbol on and everything. Uh-oh. So basically, it's going to be her dealing with them in this time with her new friend, Max, I guess. Basically, you got exactly what you expected to get after the 25-cent issue, but I think I'm going to have a lot of fun reading this storyline. I'm going to get it for at least this first storyline. I'm going to get it, whether she stays or not.
When you were saying before, Andrew, about maybe picking up an issue now and again or whatnot, that, I mean, Red Sonja, Conan-type stories, Tarzan, these types of characters, you should be able to jump on pretty much any issue and get a good experience and step out. And if you can't, then there's usually something wrong with the way that, you know, editorial is handling that book at the time. And Red Sonja's had that problem big time of late, you know, the last few iterations, as a matter of fact. You really, I don't like the installment.
Well, since Dynamite, basically.
Well, some of the earlier Dynamite stuff, even though it wasn't the greatest, it still was told
in a short story way.
But when they got into these sweeping things and the time travel and the Sonya somebody else, and you pick up the book and you can't just jump into it, that's problematic. So, cool.
One thing I did like about it, though, the blurb on the front cover page, they actually talk about Conan.
Really?
Yeah, so that was kind of neat.
Such an odd thing about how the licenses are separate. It's she's a strange beast.
I know.
Red Sonja, from her creation to her publishing history.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew, any other books?
Sure. Do you want? I'm going to be having Christmas books for a long time, but do you want What Would Phil Buy or a Christmas book?
Phil, that guy's awesome.
All right. We'll take Phil. I'll take Phil for 100, wink.
Have you guys heard of the company Keen Spot?
Yes.
Nope.
Whoa. What books of theirs do you have, Kevin?
Oh, I don't have any of their books, I don't think.
The test. The follow-up test question.
Because I saw this and I had not heard of them, so I picked up The Hunters of Salamanstra number 0. And it's John Jajesko with editors Jennifer McGregor Calpin, and art and story by John Jajesko. And it's black and white, the gray tone. I mean, the cover is color. And it's got a fox lady type with a sword, like a kind of one of them human animal hybrid types.
Okay. Yeah, that I'm like, you love.
Boy, Phil would buy this.
No,
kind of
that's
lady
your type
with a big
comic. You
tail
love
on it and a sword. And this is totally his bag.
Is she foxy?
Except she has clothes on. I mean, she's foxy in the sense she has ears like a fox and a tail, but and you know, curves and everything. So, but she keeps all her clothes on, Phil. So basically, it's this mysterious land. And there's a portal, and there's these three hunter types, including this one fox lady, and they're going in, and to go into these portals and shut them down, you have to go in to the other side and kill the demon. Mm-hmm. And apparently she feels like it's going to wipe out her world, and their urgency to do this, even though it's very dangerous. But she thinks, like, we got to stop these, we got to keep doing it. And so it's her, and she has a compadre, and then they leave one guy behind in case, you know, you always leave a guy guarding the rear. Mm-hmm. But what's weird is the guy guarding the rear has a shotgun. And I'm like, man, don't you leave the people with the swords and take the dude with the shotgun?
Well, no, because he might only have a few bullets.
But I always have that. I know everyone loves the mashup thing where it's like, we got guns and we got swords, but... Mm-hmm. pretty soon after the introduction of the gun, the sword kind of fell off as a effect, you know, like it got outmoded, especially something that looks like a modern, this isn't some muzzle loading musket. Like this looks like a shotgun and he's got a bandolier of shotgun shells and everything. And it feels, you know, a little unnecessary, but so the two of them go in and there's a really nice double page spread where she's kind of going in like in an Amanda Connor style pose, mm-hmm. with the sword behind her diving in, and the kind of alien demon she's fighting look sort of like nicer looking xenomorphs, if I had to say. And that page is really dark. The rest is a lighter shade, but that was just really nice. And the two of them go in and start kicking demon butt. And then the big demon looks like some kind of weird Sauron thing. His head are all these bones that look like interlocking bones or teeth with like one eyeball in the middle. It's pretty gnarly looking. And the demon quickly dispatches her friend Bull, kills him, just zaps him with an eye blast. And then she goes to attack him. And then we cut back to the man waiting for the two of them. And he's like getting nervous. And you see her walk out and her arm is half missing.
Oh, wow.
And she's all bloody and beat up. And then she dies right on the border. So, like, there's your hero, the cover art. And so the whole point was he now was given, like, a last request from this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to go deliver this locket. And so he's totally freaked out. And he goes to this far-off way and knocks on the door. And it ends with this young fox lady pulling a sword on him. And I guess that's who's going to be the next hero. But it's kind of cool that, like, the cover character dies, like, three hours of the way through the book. Like, nice, well played. I didn't see that coming. And the storytelling's well done. I would say there's a fair to midland influence from our friends across the ocean in this, but not to its detriment. Like, it doesn't have weird lines around the character's head when they change emotions or anything like that. But more in the stylistic trappings, less in the storytelling devices.
Oh, you mean like Kevin's type?
Yeah. But not any of that. Like, they don't shade their face red and have their hands shaking every time they talk to a woman or anything like that.
And the story makes sense. And
the story makes sense.
Not backwards, like crazy people. Right.
Is there a droplet of sweat drawn, you know?
Yeah, Not the tropes so much as just the stylistic.
No tentacle sex?
This is straight up fairly G. I mean, the one woman, you don't see the arm cut off. I mean, the character dies kind of, but it doesn't seem particularly gory or anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess the one page is kind of gory, but there's no sex whatsoever in the thing. So I'd say it's fine for most ages, unless you're particularly sensitive. The Hunters of Salamanstra, obviously taking a big guess on the spelling on all that. Not spelling, I mean the pronunciation, because I don't know. But yeah, that was my what would Phil buy at the comic book store moment.
Yeah, I probably would have picked that up.
You mentioned xenomorphs before, Andrew, and similar to what I think about Edgar Rice Burroughs characters or Conan, the Robert E. Howard characters. Also with aliens, they're kind of that concept.
This is
that,
another what would Phil would buy, I think.
Yeah, I feel like I should be able to step in every once in a while and just sort of check out what's going on. I get the idea of what the aliens are and people are having to deal with it. And so there's been a lot of aliens comics published over the decades now from Dark Horse. So I dip in every now and again, although by no means have I probably even read most of the best of the stuff, coming at it in hindsight and just grabbing things here and there. But I just read a 4-issue limited series from last year, from 2016, Aliens, Life and Death. And this is written by Dan Abnett with art by Moritat. And
miniseries is not really the right word, though, because that's part of a big series.
Right. This is... first, there was... Well, what was the previous year's whole big storyline was something else. It was Life and... or.
I forget what it was, but same type of title, yeah, and this continues right from it.
And then this year's is Life and Death, and the first miniseries was Predator, Life and Death, Mm-hmm. And then there was Prometheus, Life and Death. And now there's Aliens, Life and Death. And there are recurring characters, and it is...
Today, Aliens versus Predator, Life and Death just came out.
Okay, that's where it says to be continued in at the end of this four-issue series. There are recurring characters, but they focus on different aspects of what's going on, so it helps in the... to connect the big web that's woven here. So you kind of get a glimpse of something that's going on, and then the next series is going to kind of be about that. The whole thing is set 43 years since the Aliens movie, and a year after last year's stories. Oh, it was Fire and Stone. That's what they were.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. Now it's Life and Death. So here, this series follows a group of colonial Marines who are now trapped planetside on LV-223. They're surrounded by a horde of xenomorphs, and one engineer is walking around menacingly, like blowing up their ship to get them back up to the other ship and stuff like that. There's a big firefight, and a female, Gris, is taken by the xenomorphs. And while she's captive, she's inseminated by the queen, but she finds her comm set on the ground, and she can, from inside the hive nest with the queen, communicate with her unit on the outside, who's basically the rest of the Marines are trying to fight to survive until a possible rescue comes, as well as trying to decide whether they can and who should try to save their captured teammate, or even should they, since she's obviously a host now. But there's always in the Aliens a thing about, you know, some of the machine guys wanting to bring back like an alien host to be able to, you know, there's always that we're wanting to do research on it. So there's an angle of, well, let's save her, not to save her, but to save the thing inside her. And whereas other guys are like, should we not save her because she's got a thing inside her? And other people are just like, we got to save her. It's Chris, after all. She discovers in the alien hive tons of stillborn xenomorphs that have all popped out of all these humans and stuff. The queen is dying, and Chris has the last good egg inside her. So the queen will protect her at any cost and mm-hmm. the egg. And Chris uses this to kind of force the queen into battling with the engineer when the engineer shows up and just starts wiping out, decimating her unit. It's pretty cool. It moves along. There's good enough characterization that I was able to jump in and just grasp this small group of this small cast. The stakes are high. The story feels like it's part of something epic, even though I don't feel like I gotta grasp it all. Mm-hmm. And then, like I said, at the end, it leads into the next thing, Alien versus Predator, Life and Death, yep. because one of the Marines befriended a Predator,
mm-hmm.
and he's been off the side with him, so now he's coming into the picture, and they're going to either be helpful or antagonistic. We'll find out.
The thing I really like about this whole big storyline, too, is whether you like the Prometheus movie or not, this series really fleshes it out for you and probably would make you like it more if you didn't.
Now, you're talking about the other book that came out today. Did you pick it up?
No, I wait for the trades just because I have the Fire and Stone in trades, and I really enjoyed it, so I wanted to complete it in trades also. I did pick up the first issues of the first three minis,
okay.
but that's as far as I've read.
I wonder if it's any good.
I just bought this AVP. Just ran. It was a number one. It said number one of four.
Yeah.
That's and then the next you open part. It and it's part 13 of 17. And so I read it. And you want to know what? You don't need to have read the earlier
no,
stuff.
Not
to
really.
Be honest. No. You can jump right in.
It's nice when you do, but you don't need to for sure.
Dan Abnett, Brian Albert Thies, and Rain Berdue. And I don't know if it's just a subject matter. Steve, did you look at any of the art in this one at all?
Yeah.
It kind of reminded me of your buddy. Maybe it's a subject matter. Your man, Monsta, kind of a little bit. The Predator, especially the Predator ones. Because, you know, he's always getting those Predator sketches.
Yep.
It kind of reminded me of his art style, too. But maybe it was just the subject matter. So they, it picks up where they take, you know, they're stuck. Kind of. The only thing I didn't know is I didn't know who the engineers were. I was expecting Thomas the Tank Engine. No.
Me neither.
Oh, really? Wow.
The only other part that was really confusing was I wasn't really sure why this Chris person would want to keep living unless something has changed. That's like the birth of those things kills you and it seems horrific. Mm-hmm. Like maybe I'm a coward, but wouldn't you rather go to sleep forever than, unless there's now a cure for it. I don't know. Maybe in the future they have a cure for getting those things out of you
in Prometheus,
without killing you. There's a chance.
Yeah, in Prometheus there was a character, the movie, that had something in her. I forget if it was an alien or what it was, but they used a machine to get it out, I think.
They mentioned something about an opportunity to, if they got to her, the one girl who's her bestie who wants to get her out the most, and when she is making her argument about why, one of the things is, but we can get her aboard the ship and put her in the whatever and try to, and they're like, well, that's a long shot, but... So I think there is a long shot that they might be able to say. But then there was the other angle where the administration level was hoping to get their hands on the unbirthed xenomorph. But that wouldn't affect her thinking. She doesn't want it.
No. Well, also, it seems like they're her friend. Like, this seems like a tight crew. And the other problem is it doesn't seem like they're being harried by the aliens and then the upcoming predators. So it doesn't really seem like they have a lot of options. It's not like, oh, we just got to get her to the thing. It's like they have to survive. And part of surviving is dragging her increasingly less helpful person. Like I said, I understand the ticking clock a little bit, but it just seems like, especially sort of the fatalistic mindset of usually the alien movies, which are more, and the Predator movies, which I haven't kept up with, but the original ones definitely... There was no way I was going to, nor the characters, I think, would be like, usually they ended up blowing themselves up or whatever if they ended up getting one of them things planted in your stomach, because, man, it doesn't look good. You know what I mean? When that thing matures. But it ends with, like, a whole army of predators. Because the other thing I can never figure out is, who do you make better? You know,
predators.
In this one, the predators.
Villains, though.
In this one, the predators seem to be more kick-ass than the aliens.
Well, yeah,
but the aliens seem to win.
They have a code and everything.
Yeah, but I would think that the aliens are just as kick-ass, because they get the acid blood and you have to be careful when you kill them and all that.
See, that's what gets me about the alien thing, and I understand it's about moving it forward and raising the stakes and all that. But the original Alien movie was Haunted House in Outer Space, right? I mean, there's the one creeper in the night, and because it's so alien, pun intended, they don't know how to deal with it, and it's so unpredictable that every time they try to do, it's one step ahead of them. They cut it, and all of a sudden, its blood is going through all of the floors, and it might like burn its way out of the hull and compromise like their oxygen. Right? It's like, holy, we never thought of that. They don't understand its incubation system and all that, how it morphs and how it attacks, and it's like the perfect creature, and it just, one of them is more than enough for a whole crew to handle with all of their weaponry and stuff. I guess they didn't have that many weapons on the ship, but
well, that's the thing, remember, they weren't like Marines or anything.
The second movie, it's a hive mentality. It seems like if you had 5 bullets in your gun, you could kill 5 aliens. And that minimizes that creepiness of the creature itself, and it turns it's in mass hive numbers, and I don't like it as much. That's zombies, you know?
That's the more popular movie, though, from fans,
I'm just saying what I like about my aliens, and what you're saying here is same thing with the Predator. You're making it is the one Predator is pretty intense, but then a group of Predators...
Yeah,
how intense is any one of them?
Right, subordinate to the... They also always seem like a solitary kind of... Like, that was the whole point of them. They were like hunters, and then the end of this has like a squad of them.
No, they've always been in squads. It's just
I seem to remember Arnie only killed one of them.
That's because, for example, if you look at the second movie, it's because the rest died in a crash.
I don't look at the second movie, Phil. It's the first. If it bleeds, we can kill
but
it.
But everything that even came after the movies, it's always been squad.
It's just you.
But
and
I
me,
like that this
the
is
big
comics.
Old moon in the sky.
This is comics, so they can make 100 predators if they want. I mean, that's this if this is the place to do that stuff. So I get it.
Yeah, but like you say, then strategically or logistically, it feels somewhat diminishing.
Do you guys have a favorite Aliens or Predator storyline from the old stuff?
No. For me, it would be probably something with great art. I mean, for me, it would be that first, the
12-issue one?
No, the graphic novel from that Heavy Metal put out in the 70s that Archie Goodwin and Walt Simonson did of the movie, where it was and it was off the script, so it had parts that weren't in the movie, that kind of stuff. Wow. But yeah, and they did an artist edition of it and a reprinting of it a few several years ago. Actually, there's probably some cheap copies out there actually right now. But yeah, I mean that's Simonson doing Aliens, you know.
Have you guys been reading the Image comic Cannibal at all?
No.
Southern original.
I flipped through the first issue to see if it was up my alley or not, and I found it wanting, but that doesn't mean it's not a good book.
It is a good book. It's actually a very good book. The art is nice to look at. It's a very slow book, though. It basically, there's four issues out right now, and that's the end of the first story arc, and then it continues in May, but I found, like, it's almost like they were missing an issue to finish this arc, kind of, because, like, things were just finally starting to pick up. But all the characters, like, I'm getting into the characters. The main character, one of them's pretty much a deadbeat dad. He's kind of hard to like at all, but that's how he's meant to be. But basically, it's in a small town in Florida. Basically, I forget what happened, but basically people are turning into cannibals. Like, it's like a sickness or a virus, and it just happens, and they want the taste of flesh. They're not, like, mindless or crazy. They just can't control themselves. And this town is, because it's a small community, they haven't had to experience any of that yet. So this fourth storyline is just that, the cannibal stuff starting to leak into their town.
Hmm.
And, like, kind of follows the deadbeat dad around and some other characters. I love the covers. And just the look of the book, the art, everything. And I'm going to continue to pick it up now that it's just starting to pick up more. But yeah, I can see it not being your thing for sure, Steve. It's not gory or anything like that. Or at least yet.
Give it time.
Yeah, I imagine it will be.
Come on. Cannibalism, gory? I don't think so, Phil.
I love cannibalism stuff.
Well, Canada, you like poutine, so it makes sense. Is that an option at Tim Hortons?
Tim Hortons is old now. Everyone goes to Starbucks.
What? Where do you live?
Tim Hortons sucks these days. It's like, oh, it's garbage.
Everyone goes there religiously, like there's cocaine in the coffee.
Awful.
What have you been reading, Kevin?
Valiant. Do you have to ask, Steve?
What's what I was waiting for?
Have I brought up Divinity before? I don't remember.
A few hundred times.
A few hundred times, okay.
Yeah. I think I did once.
How good is it, Kevin? How good is Divinity?
It's pretty good.
Because that's the space dude?
Yeah.
I don't like that one too much. I couldn't get in.
Sell me on the premise, Kevin.
Well, the Divinity 1, we're up to Divinity 3 now.
Okay.
So Divinity 1 was, like, basically the Soviets
sent
someone into space, like, deep space.
And then he sees, like, butterfly creatures and stuff or something weird.
Yeah,
like
he sees some crazy stuff, but, so, I guess the Soviets were thinking, like, they would win the space race, but...
Instead, we got this boring character.
I guess this isn't going well, Phil.
Sorry.
But in the first one, like, this guy comes back to Earth and he has, like, basically powers of a god, like, basically any cosmic crazy character, you know what I mean, that has a lot of power. But I guess if you were looking
Mr. Majestic, maybe, would be a good person.
But I guess if you're looking for a direct old Valiant equivalent, you would say Solar, I guess.
Yeah.
But, so then, you know, he fights a bunch of people, whatever, right? That's the first Divinity.
And he gets in touch with his feelings. That's basically the whole mini.
Yeah, yeah. I guess you could say you know when everyone hated. See, people didn't hate Divinity, but it kind of reminds me in a certain way after I said that whatever of the century at Marvel, where he was just sitting on a couch and he was trying to get in touch with his feelings,
mm-hmm.
and people was like, "Why doesn't he do something?" Of course, that's probably not as allowable as at Marvel as at another company, right? Because the other company might have different standards and things set up a different way. So people would be like, oh, that's cool. So Divinity 2 is the second astronaut that went into space.
Oh, it's not the same character anymore. Okay.
No. Because you had a whole crew, like, I think maybe three? I don't think it's four. Probably three characters that went up in this space shuttle. And you probably thought the other two were dead. And it seems like the second one kills the third one. So in the second one, basically, it's two gods fighting. So now we're in the third one. So I'm wondering, well, is the third character coming back? Because you start the series, and basically the Soviet Union has taken over the world. And it's called the Stalinverse.
Oh, so it's not canon, then.
But you know what I like about this, Steve? On the first page, they start out with a historical timeline.
Nice.
And if there's things I like, it's the cutaways. Timelines. So basically, it looks like the timeline is like our world. But as things start changing, like however they were changed, I'm thinking one of these characters or something probably figured out how to change time somehow since they're godlike. So it seems like our world, and as the timeline goes down, it's sort of like a butterfly effect, where if you change this event, then these other things happen until the world is just totally screwed up. Does that sound interesting?
I saw a robot chicken short about that.
And that stupid movie with the 70s guy.
So you basically get...
Yeah.
That's what I liked about Lazarus, too, when they set up Lazarus, you know what I mean, Rucka's book there.
Yes!
With the timelines and stuff and the false history and where things deviated from ours. And you can kind of think, oh, what if it kind of goes that way because you're starting off where we are now, you know?
Well, it's kind of funny. You see things like U.S. presidents and everything, like, they're like, oh, well, they became like some... Like not super soldier, but like they were like some rebel leader and they get killed in Cuba and all this stuff. And you're like, wait, that's not how President Kennedy died or whatever. So you get to see all your favorite valiant heroes, like basically become, agents of the Soviet Union, except for Ninjak, because he's Ninjak. That's what I'm learning with every Valiant story. If you have Ninjak, he's Ninjak, so he's okay. Like there was some weird story where because his future self cured his present day self, and then he says, "Oh well, I know that I'm going to do that in the future. My future self did that, so I can cure myself in present day." And this is Matt Kent writing. So when he did that, I was just like, What is going on with this story? How does that work?" But this is also Trevor Hersing on artwork, so it looks pretty good too.
Yeah,
I think probably some of his better work has come out of Valiant. But kind of a crazy book. And Ninjak, who doesn't like Ninjak, right?
I like Ninjak. He's actually pretty good.
And when you said
he's a ninja and Union Jack.
When you say Divinity 3, it's the third issue? It's the third series?
Third what mini. Is
it? Third oh, okay. series, but okay. first issue.
So is it like Divinity 3 with like a Roman numeral?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Cool.
So like one of them's trapped in a prison. One of them's like in a staff, like you can sort of wish him you know, like a genie, he comes out and helps you out. Bloodshot's sort of like going to disrupt protests and crazy stuff like that. And there's a scene where there's like a tripwire, and the guys are like, oh yeah, we're gonna set up this trap for him, and instead of avoiding the tripwire, he just walks right through it. He's just like, eh. So I gotta say, I've been enjoying it anyways. But I want to know, like, how this fits in and what happened.
I don't.
And now,
I did not like the character at all.
Back to Dark Horse Comics after that excursion to other publishing companies.
Are they sponsoring us?
It seems like it tonight.
The check cashed, Steve, right?
Last episode was sponsored by Shark Week.
Which was a long time ago when we recorded.
It was a long time ago.
Episode is sponsored by Dark Horse Comics. Theoretically, symbolically. But I read Dead Inside, number one, which is
sounds familiar.
By John Arcudi, with art by Tony Fazula, under a Dave Johnson cover. The protagonist here is a scrappy female cop named Caruso. She got transferred to a prison system detective beat when she wasn't successful being like a street detective. So they kind of stuck her where, as she says, she wouldn't do too much damage and could sort of disappear and stay a low profile. But it's okay, because she never wanted to be a detective anyway. She was plenty happy being a uniformed deputy, where she describes herself as excelling. But when you're a detective for the prison system, eventually your number gets called, and there's a murder at a prison. This scrawny inmate has hacked to death this huge, violent guy, and then goes to the kitchen and hangs himself. And to Caruso, it doesn't add up. She's like, the little guy killed the big guy? And then she finds out that the little guy was going to be paroled in 5 months, so like, why would he do this and then kill himself? Let's see, the surveillance camera conveniently doesn't work. Some of the cameras work, but they've supposed to be getting funding, but the state hasn't written the check yet, that kind of thing. So she's dealing with, you know, a rundown prison system kind of thing. She's, even though it's the modern times, by putting her in this environment, she's not getting the modern benefits that a detective would have access to. Plus, she's getting, like, rushed through the prison. The crime scene's been compromised. They're already, like, cleaning up the kitchen where he hung himself. But there is a surveillance camera there, and it shows the skinny guy going and gobbling down like a carton of milk or something right before he hangs himself. And she's like, did he pop a pill there? She's wondering. And she wants to get a toxicology screen on him to see if there's like some sort of drug thing. And no one's cooperating or willing to authorize it. So she's like up against the system. The body's getting moved. She can't get the test she wants done. She's got this hunch and enough dedication to the truth in her job to push and try to follow through, but everything's against her. Nobody cares to necessarily, nobody even wants her around. She goes home and her ex-boyfriend gives her a call and stops by to tell her that he's getting remarried. You know, this is the kind of day this lady's having. And at the end of the first issue, she has an epiphany. And in the middle of the night goes and gets a friend to do an x-ray of the body. Not a toxicology screen or anything that she can get in trouble for having done unauthorized, but just a quick x-ray that no one will be able to tell was done. And she finds something, well, I won't say. I can't wait for issue number two, though. It's intriguing.
Is it a xenomorph in the stomach?
Yeah. The tone felt a lot to me like the High Crimes book that I enjoyed over the last few years. The way the art is, the tone of the book, the unsuccessful at life but still has the skills and some of the training to persevere type character of the female protagonist. It's good. I don't know if how long of a series this is supposed to be, but it's good so far. I'm definitely going to be following up on it. All right, I've shot my dark horse wad. Who's got something else?
I have a Christmas thing, but it's not dark horse.
Uh-oh.
Oh, well, then I can't
get lose our sponsorship for next episode.
No, that bird's flown.
It's IDW. We know them. They're from this one's from a few years ago, 2014. But it's from the Yo Books imprint. We like them. So it's edited by Craig Yo and Fester Faceplant. And it's a fancy hardcover with nice, soft cloth kind of textured cover. You guys could probably guess who is featured in this book. I don't think he just goes by one name.
Just one name.
Ditko.
Oh, okay.
It's true. It's 80% of the time it's going to be that.
And this is the 1, 2, and 3 pagers.
Yes.
Didn't they have another one, or was that short stories of Ditko?
So this is collecting... the title is a small clue. It's all... one pagers, two pagers, and three pagers. Wow. What's interesting is it's a little run, like, there's nothing past, like, the mid-70s. So it's the earlier run. But what's sort of enjoying is his takes at humor.
Yes.
Which is not something you would normally associate. The other thing I do like is they cite where each one comes from down in little print in the bottom, so you know if you want to run down these out of this world number 3 or whatever. But like I said, this... He does one that's like out of Mad Magazine about different car shows with General Voters and Flymouth and Bolshevik Revolutioner and funny on the Jaguar. It's a cat driving it, the Jagger. What I think I like about it is how badly humor ages, this type of humor. That's making particular mockery of whatever's going on. I'm also just seeing him do it, but, you know, it's also got all these great science fiction ones that are the total O. Henry Twilight Zone endings with Ditko characters going to crazy places. Those are obviously the tops. I mean, the humor is just interesting by way of contrast. I don't think it's really his strongest suit. And like I said, that stuff for me ages poorly anyways, but... You know, it's got dinosaurs and spaceships and
dinosaurs in spaceships?
And crazy guys that are trapped in weird dimensions. And one of them is a guy that they find out, how can he have prices up in Alaska so cheap for his steaks? And he found a frozen dinosaur that he carves the steaks in him. And like, you know, no one does bad guys the way he, you know, his bad guys just... You look at him and you're like, that's a sleazy guy.
Yeah, it's right? the eyebrows, they give it away.
So, and then there's even a, like, Western stories and precursor sort of superhero characters, but they're not, they're like the Spectre types. You know, those ones that used to be in the horror ones that would tell you, like, bad things are going to happen to Jim because he's a bad man type of, I guess the Crypt Keeper would be a better description. But I do love my favorite had to be the Black Fury story from Black Fury number 18, which I guess was a horse, was the star of the comic book.
Talking?
So, like, no dialogue. It's just the horse, like evading
Lilith Hobo?
Yeah, the horse is evading these wolves. Like, there's no people in it. It's about a horse. So, I'm like, wow, I'm kind of curious about Black Fury now. Is it all just... You know, total dialogue-free animals being animals, not being, like, funny people. The other thing that's interesting is he's very consistent over, you know, you're looking at this book spans a good 20 years at least, probably closer to 30. Because I think there's stuff from the 40s in here. But it's mostly 50s, 60s, and 70s. And, like, it's very consistent. Like, he is just... the consummate pro. But it's a good for me because I don't like necessarily the old comics, but reading these little shorts by a curator I like is the way for me to do it. Generally, I know, Kevin, you're more into like picking up weird old books from that time period, but this for me, I'm controlling who I'm reading about, and I know it's going to be good, and hey, if I don't like it, at worst, it's 3 pages.
Try again on the next one.
But this one was 2014, so I was a little bit nervous. It was tough, a little bit tougher to find, I guess, but she was able to wrangle me a copy, which I am much grateful for.
And Kevin, you asked, aren't they publishing some other old Ditko stories? And yes, Yo was also, they're like larger than digest sized, but smaller than, you know, your usual hardcover size. And he had a few volumes of the older stuff, and some of it is pretty vanilla. There's only, I think I picked up the last one of them. But this, like Andrew says, it's so nice to be able to just jump in and not have to invest more than a couple of pages before you're out of the thing. Back to the next one.
Well, but guys, what about Scribd? No one gives any attention to Scribd. I think I've talked about. I'm probably the person that's talked about the most about Scribd. I gave them the most press that anyone gave them.
Well, as you said, I used them for finding other resources like journals and stuff. But I never thought the site was that great an interface.
No, it wasn't.
I felt like I just didn't. They weren't inviting. But I'm clearly not their I don't know who their target demographic was. Maybe people that are more computer literate. But it's not like I'm totally futz. I can know where the carburetor is. I know my way about a computer.
Well, maybe their target audience shouldn't have been me, because they don't carry comics anymore.
Yeah, they pulled the plug on the comic scene.
I noticed, like, in October, because I was still checking every week, and I'm like, so did you add anything new? Like, are those Turtles issues up? Did like, 6 months of Valiant go up again or whatever? And then I'm like, stuff is being removed. Because you could, like, go under a certain publisher category and see how many titles they had. And at one point, IDW dropped to, like, 1,000, and it never went above again. And you're like, oh, that's not a good sign. It's only some... And you could even... There was even fragments of, like, ghost books that weren't there anymore.
How does that work?
And it was just like, what is going on? Oh, so, yeah. Pour one out for the comics on Scribd. But I could see that totally happening. Once Comixology had their subscription thing with the muscle of Amazon, and I'm like, why are people ever going to go over to Scribd anymore? Like, really?
Well, I think it would only be if their base wanted it. Like, if you're already on... Like, if I'm already on a platform, I'm, again, might not be the right person, but I'd stay on the platform because I'm like, well,
yeah,
I know this. Like, I like the interface or whatever.
Says the guy who hates digital comics.
I read a lot more digital comics than I publicly admit on forum, but no, I've come around. I do the unlimited and everything, and now that I have a tablet that I like,
it's better.
It's a lot better.
Sure is.
It had a lot of I don't know if this is just their marketing speak at the beginning, but they're like, oh yeah, people love comics on there, and then by the time that they're admitting that they actually pulled some and shutting down, they're like, oh, not that many users were using it.
Well, I imagine the license fees weren't great either.
Yeah.
Because it's not like a magazine or something. It's pretty pricey. I mean, yeah, an individual comic might be slightly less than a magazine, but it's also less content. Like, most magazines are pretty thick.
I'll tell you,
I just thought it was interesting, because you sent that thing to me about Publishers Weekly saying, hey, they removed stuff. And I'm like, why didn't anyone talk about this months ago? Because I remember people tweeting at Scribd saying, what, comics aren't here? I'm canceling my account and everything. But that it was like 2 or 3 people. And they never responded, or I didn't see any replies, and everyone else was just talking about other stuff. And I was like, good thing I didn't buy a yearly subscription or something. Like, I don't know if I would have been able to get that money back.
Probably not.
Well, if you're looking for other things to read online, I can tell you, and I'm going to talk about it probably next episode, just about everything going on the panelsyndicate.com Brian Vaughn and Marcos Martin's website there is great. All three books they got going there have been very entertaining. And Comixology's continuing to pump out a lot of indie books. I scanning around, I found a few good things in there, and they've been putting out some old stuff, including some volumes of Richard Sala's stuff that's not in print. So it's been fun to find some non-in-print stuff there. And he's not the only author, too, artist that I've found books from that I haven't been able to find in print. So that's kind of fun about the digital angle.
Well, I got to say, I bought a whole bunch of Richard Sala stuff for my nephews, and I read it before I sent it out. Because, you know, I'm cheap like that. It was fun reading all that. I'm like, this will be good for kids. It's kind of all, I mean, it's a little dark at times, but, I mean, they're now young men. Like, they're college age, so they're not little kids, but
they can handle
it. So it's funny, acceptable. But he has a sort of a, like, he has done, I think, some all ages stuff or whatever. Yes. So he just fits. He has like a universal style and a attitude, I think, that works. Because I didn't want to send, you can't send superhero stuff to non-comic book people.
Sure.
I mean, it just doesn't work. My personal opinion. Like, unless you want them just to throw it out or give it away. Like,
wow.
Superhero books are only for superhero readers.
Yeah.
Like,
wow.
They don't have much interest in that. But you can find a lot of great non-superhero comics to send people.
Sala's book, if you're ever looking for a book to get a preteen or teenage girl, right? What comic would be good there? It's like Too Old for the Ponies, but you know what I mean? And maybe even beyond some of the Archie stuff. Or maybe
also, I think the wrong gender for the Ponies.
But is,
aren't the Ponies all mid-30s men?
But Sala's Cat Burglar Black.
It's I sent that. That was one of the ones I got.
And there's death and murder in it and stuff, but it's a great, great book, really entertaining. And I think it even won some young reader awards.
Some young punk awards.
Yeah.
But no, well, the one thing I admire about you, Steve, is you take the dive on. Like, I'll read I'll buy random paper stuff, but your willingness to buy random digital stuff is truly inspirational. I feel like digital, I still have a hard time, unless it's a known quantity, pulling the trigger on paying for it.
Well,
except for Kickstarter. I still back those with some weird, although I've cut back on those a lot.
But you know what's hilarious? I'll say, oh, I'm going to like try these digital or something like that. What was it, Heathrin? That was a Kickstarter?
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh, now they're doing the paper copies through Vault. And I'm like, oh, I'll pick these up. And I'm like, well, why didn't I just, I don't know. It's just sometimes, like, paper stuff sometimes is just easier still for me to just, oh, yeah, I'm interested in that. That's cool.
Yeah, but how would you have even noticed the he, you know what I mean? Would you have noticed it if you hadn't already checked it out? I don't But
I don't know, because I remember the Kickstarter.
You would have heard about us talking nice about it.
Well
that's what
that's because we did it, though.
Because he listens to indie comic books.
See, but nothing matches. Like, walking down a con floor with Andrew and having him stopping at the stuff that I would just breeze by, and he's, like, talking up stuff and getting characters of himself in books and things by people. you amaze me at some of the indie books you pick up, or some of the pamphlets even you're willing to grab as we're walking the con floor.
Well, the same thing with like TCAF. It's easier to just pass by those tables. That looks cool. And just pick stuff up.
That's because you secretly love art comics more than anything else. You just don't want it getting out there.
You know what was pretty amazing, and I might cover for the next episode, is, you know, one year I bought, like, you know, my whole space... was it Jupiter and Titan and all that?
Yes.
Crazy subgenre thing. I picked up the first issue 1 year. Then the next year I picked up like 2 and 3. And I saw number 4 solicited in previews. And I actually made a special order for that. Okay. So I didn't have to pick it up at the next TCAF. I actually special ordered an issue of that.
Look at you.
So that's pretty incredible, like the transition there I made.
Yeah.
Look at you all grown up.
I know. Jeez.
I want to do an honorable mention too, then. I picked up today Donald Quest, issues 1 to 3.
Whoa.
By DW. 40 pages for $3.99, which is awesome. And it basically, it looks like a, kind of like a Lord of the Rings space kind of mashup adventure in Duckburg. It looks really fun. And it's crazy that IDW still does the Disney comics.
Yeah, well,
it's good hands. It's in good hands. For
I also don't know how many of those are reprints from like Europe or whatever.
Some of them do. Like, that one of the advertisements of the one I almost picked up, which I'm going to now, it's 72 pages an issue, and it's from Europe. It's Duck Avenger. And they just brought it over here for the first time.
For some reason, for all my Disney love, I don't know, the Disney comics never really grabbed me.
Well, me, I like Uncle Scrooge because I was a big DuckTales fan. And then like the ones like this where it's kind of like, it's not normal, you know, like it's an adventure story or kind of thing.
The old Duck books, those were awesome. Don Rosa stuff and... You know, the Carl Park stuff,
Beagle
Brothers, and it was like, Caspery kinds of stuff.
And you really get your bang for your buck, too.
Yeah, I tried a few reprints of that, and it never, I don't know, I
love Animal People.
You know who else Disney puts out books with is a publisher, Joe Books.
Yeah, Darkwing Duck, I get that.
Yeah, they've got two things going on the side. I think Marvel published reprints of some of the Boom
like
stuff.
Fairy ones and stuff.
Some of the Boom stuff that they had, like the Muppets and things along those lines. So it's funny how they've pulled some of it back, and Marvel's doing some Disney things related to like the theme parks, like the Haunted House and the Tiki, Enchanted Tiki Room and stuff. So it's funny how Disney has got a few different outlets for their stuff.
Joe Books, I believe it's because he owns the property. The guy that invented Darkwing Duck. I think he kind
of
owns
He put out these comic cine stories of like Frozen and Tangled and things where they actually took animation cells from the movie and put comic word balloons on them.
We ended up with one of those for, I bought it randomly, sight unseen through Amazon for the Zootopia one.
Okay, there
I didn't
you go.
No, I was like, a Zootopia comic. Then I got it, and I'm like, man, this is not what I thought it was going to be drawn, but it's like the old-timey photo books almost.
Yeah. And,
like,
and they're doing ongoing comics of Frozen. Joe
that makes sense. That's like a popular... They should be doing...
Who doesn't want to see Elsa in the dress?
And, I mean, wait for Disney to do it, because now you get... different companies doing all their different lines and
chance
I don't know,
to grab
I think that's
yeah idiot. And they each have their own niche that and places their yeah I like it too
yeah it's but more... Boom lost out there. It was kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kaboom.
They could still put in a bid. I bet I just think they don't want to probably take the haircut that they're probably gonna have to take to keep the license.
They've got all the Cartoon Network stuff.
Oh yeah. That's true. Yeah,
yeah.
All right, any other books? Are we satisfied with what's off our chest here?
See, I mean, I have another one I could mention.
All right, come on, Andrew.
All right, out. I feel bad because I wasn't as impressed as I wanted to be. But I got the Cyberforce Artifacts from Top Cow.
Oh, I almost picked that up.
You don't really need it. What it is it's these little short story versions. The problem is, like, I really like, as you know, the one artist. Great. Now my brain just totally froze up and it's failing to reboot.
Sylvester?
But no, the guy that did the speedster in the book.
Oh, Velocity?
Yeah.
Kenneth Rocafort?
Yeah, I really like him. So to see these characters by, Aurelia and Jim Toe, who are great artists, but you know what I mean? I just think of his version because a lot of it, if there's a lot of Velocity in this.
Well, she kind of took over. Like, that's the character that always showed up after Cyberforce came out a long time ago. You know, she was always the main focus, it seemed.
So, and as much as those two artists are great, and I just so associate her with Rocafort that it's really hard for me to jive on other people's take on the character because otherwise it's just a regular old speedster. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's nothing.
And don't leave my pal Ron Mars out of it because he wrote a good character. Velocity was a pretty decent book.
Yeah. So this is Kelly Bender, Camilla Zhang, Paul Penna. I mean, it's a big book, and like I like the multiple little stories in it, but I don't know. I just I feel like $4, it's kind of heavy. I guess if you're a huge Cyberforce fan, this is talking to you. I'm not really a big Cyberforce fan.
I like the beginning stuff, but yeah, it kind of lost me after that.
I'm more of an art, you know, buying it for the art type of thing. And like I said, while the two art teams are great, they're just not the art team I'm used to on this book. That's my failing, not theirs. But if you're in the camp with me, then this is probably not the book for you either. But it doesn't plus, hurt, you know. I'm
plus,
like,
it's an artifact book, so that means it ties into all that whole, all that universe stuff, I imagine. So it must be confusing at parts, no?
It is, but I, you know, this Top Cow stuff, like, it's all half garbage, and like, it just,
oh yeah,
it's not garbage, it's garbage, but it's just, it's like superhero Argo Bargo. Like, if you can't pick up random dense continuity Argo Bargo superhero book and work through it, you know, you haven't read 30 years worth of comics. So even if you don't particularly understand the reference, like, you know, I think we've all reached the point where we've read so many damn comics that as long as it's well constructed, even if it's the densest continuity ever, like, the patterns and the cycles are all okay. This is this type of person. Okay, this is this type of situation. Okay, I don't know what the rings of Ragaduccio are, but I can figure out what they mean here,
like, and
what
this character
means, or that sort of thing based on that. Enough. I mean, I did like the Force in the Morning short story was Camilla Zhang, Francisco Aurelia one, where it's a young Velocity. And so the kind of stylized artwork works more because it's not like the Velocity. I mean, you know, by pushing the character a lot younger, it puts it in a different mindset and works better for me. I mean, it's not bad. I think this is for hardcore Cyberforce, unless this is the new ongoing team. The other problem with Top Cow is I never know what's ongoing or not.
Yeah, and there can't be any hardcore Cyberforce fans left. There's no way.
Oh, there's got to be at least one, right?
It was never really a series that, like, they had a couple minis or one-shots and stuff, but it really never really picked off like some of the other Image ones did.
All right, to end on a lighter nostalgic note, I got an even older Image book.
Whoa.
To throw out at you. It's Jack King Kirby's final project brought to your newsstand. It's the Phantom Force from Image Comics. It ran from
I remember that.
In the fall of 1993 is when it started. And I have the first three issues, although by the third issue, it was all written and penciled by Michael Thibodeau. And inked by Marty Lasek, and Kirby was gone by at that point. But this is the first issue, at least, is all written and penciled by Kirby, and then the second ish is, I think it's like 54 pages, and the first 42 is written and penciled by Kirby, and the last 12 is drawn by this Michael Thibodeau. The first issue, I mean, the idea is basically that Thibodeau had co-ownership of the property and it was unfinished, and therefore Thibodeau was able to shop it around himself to try to get it published, and the Image guys, being young and full of dough at the time and having this avenue for publishing, wanted more than anything to have the opportunity to ink over Kirby. And Thibodeau provided them with that opportunity to ink Kirby's original pencils, not over vellum. So that's pretty cool. They got to ink over the real stuff, and they agreed to put it out and donate the money to Kirby, the proceeds. So it's Kirby's pencils and concepts, and unfortunately, you know, also his, it's his, the sluggishness of his writing, especially at that time. But it's inked by Liefeld, McFarlane, Jim Lee, Mark Silvestri, Eric Larson, Scott Williams, Jerry Ordway, and Danny Meekie.
Yikes. Wow.
Yeah, everyone wanted a piece of those, mm-hmm. those Kirby pages to ink. And, you know, the second issue as well, inked by these guys. And there's some pinups.
Surprised it ever came out then, because from that Image crossover that we're still waiting for.
Well, and the back of the first issue has testimonials from all the artists of what Kirby meant to them and how great this was for them to do. And there's a couple of pinups, and obviously the covers. The first issue has inks by Liefeld. The second by Larson and the third by McFarlane. So it's cool to see the King, and it's funny to see the heavy inks of these egos, right? That are like, you know, these guys who are like, you know, we're the next Kirby and everything. It's pretty funny.
Well, I mean, I gotta imagine Eric Larson was probably pretty faithful to the line.
Oh, for sure.
They want for their own. I'll post some images. It's pretty funny to see what some of these guys did with it.
Wait, so Liefeld wasn't a seamless anchor over Kirby? Oh.
And on that note, that's another episode of Indie Comic Book Noise. Long live the King. Thanks, guys.
I got the perfect book.
It's too late.
Where were you?
I know. Where were you?
I saw a werewolf with a Chinese menu in his hand, walking through the streets of Soho in the rain. He was looking for the place called Lee Ho Fook's. Gonna get a big dish of beef chow mein. Werewolves of London. Werewolves of London. You hear him howling round your kitchen door. You better not let him in. Little old lady got mutilated late last night. Werewolves of London again. In Kent, and lately he's been overheard in Mayfair. You better stay away from him. He'll rip your lungs out, Jim. Ha! I'd like to meet his tailor. Ah-hoo. Werewolves of London. Of London. When I saw Lon Chaney walking with the Queen, and they were doing the Werewolves of London. I saw Lon Chaney Jr. walking with the Queen, and they were doing the Werewolves of London. I saw a werewolf drinking a pina colada in Trader Vic's, and his hair was. Oh!